everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. Today we'll be delving into the behind-the-scenes scoop and casting lore behind one of the greatest films of all time, filled with intrigue, romance, and political warfare, the 1942 film Casablanca, which recently celebrated its 80th anniversary. So with that being said, we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello, everybody. I'm so glad you can join us. My name is Norma Levy, and I'm the founder and president of New Plaza Cinema. And today we're looking forward to a lively discussion about that amazing 1942 film, Casablanca. And now I'm pleased to introduce the host for this talkback, our wonderful curator, Gary Palmucci.
Well, thank you, Norma. Good afternoon, everyone. The thing that has struck me the most about this film is how an American classic whose signature song is As Time Goes By has reverberated in my own life.
As time goes.
50 years ago, as a high school senior, I saw it for the first time, first of several times. And 5 years ago, I took my son to see it for his first time on its 75th anniversary. He subsequently discussed it with his grandmother, who at age 90 still vividly recalled seeing it in its original release, also as a high school senior. And 5 years later, we're celebrating her 95th and the movie's 80th birthday.
I'm betraying my youth here, but my first exposure to Casablanca was in the Woody Allen film, Play It Again, Sam.
Year, 50 years ago.
December of 72. It opens with the airport scene towards the end, and I hadn't seen Casablanca before. And then a year or two later, I got to see the entire film. But it was not only satirized in that film by Woody Allen and Diane Keaton and Tony Roberts. It was actually paid homage to by Steven Soderbergh in 2006 in his George Clooney, Kate Blanchett film, The Good German, which is a deliberate tribute at the end to Casablanca, right down to the prop plane and the back lighting and all the smoke and mirrors that made that famous scene in the original. So time.
Well, I imagine in Milwaukee, as was the case for me in Boston, there was an independent channel which had a big chunk of the Warner Brothers library and was constantly running The Maltese Falcon, The Treasury of Sierra Madre, Key Largo, They Drive By Night, The Roaring Twenties. That was my introduction to Bogart. And of course, Casablanca was one of those from that storied library, which you also spent some time studying the files of, I believe, right, at the University of Wisconsin?
You know, I did not have that pleasure. I know others such as Stephen Smith have actually got into the Casablanca papers. My knowledge of the film has to do with that amazing book that I know we've talked about before, Inside Warner Brothers, which reprints a lot of the memoranda. But the other day when we were talking about the film itself at New Plaza Cinema, I was recalling a 1986 Museum of Modern Art exhibition where they displayed a lot of the Warner Brothers memos. And there were some great Casablanca memos from Hal Wallace and Michael Curtiche and others that didn't make it into that Warner Brothers book that I mentioned. And there were some very funny things about Casablanca.
I think our special guest, Alan Rohde, we were discussing this the other day. He is intimately familiar with all those memos, those in the book and out of the book, including one that I thought had a little more credence than he advised us it does. In the early stages of casting, Ronald Reagan and Ann Sheridan were being considered for the leads in the film, which would have been, you know, some kind of nightmarish situation as far as posterity is concerned. That's just an urban myth of some sort, as we'll hear soon.
I guess a good place to start would be on the enduring power of Casablanca, the fact that 80 years later, we're still discussing it and that it seems to affect people of all generations. It works on so many different levels, depending on what your interests are. If you're into the romance is there, the love affair that cannot be positively fulfilled to its furthest level because of the marriage situation between the woman. There's the political aspects, refugees seeking visas. There's the humor that's just unstoppable in some of those scenes in the cafe. We can just go on and on. What do you think some of the enduring aspects?
Well, I think the thing that struck me most this week was when the picture started shooting, I'm guessing sometime in maybe the first quarter of 1942. And by no means was it a sure thing at this point that Germany was going to lose the war. You know, this is a few months or weeks after Pearl Harbor. And all the setbacks in the Pacific, things were going pretty badly for the Allies at this point. So I think there really was a whole different frame of mind among the participants making the film and the many expatriates who are in the movie who fled various countries, Germany, France, et cetera, to get the hell out of there. I mean, the world was in a pretty grim spot at this point in ways that I don't think we can really even wrap our heads around in our generation, despite all the mishigas going on, you know, suspending the Constitution and the Ukraine and all the things that go on here at this moment in time.
Casablanca is one of the very few films of 1942-43. It falls into the propaganda category. Clearly, it was designed to build support for the war effort, but it's one of the very few that holds up from those years. And yes, you have some speechifying. Yes, you have some morale-boosting scenes, but there are all these other levels that elevated above everything else that was being ground out by the studios. It transcends propaganda, really. It works on so many different levels, and for reasons that I've kind of alluded to.
Well, when they sing the Marseillaise, I mean, they really mean it. That really gets you, stirs you up every single time that we hear it.
Absolutely, and one of those Warner Brothers memos included something from Hal Wallace that gave instructions that even though Victor Laszlo is leading a small group of musicians at the cafe to play the Marseillaise, Wallace wanted a full symphonic orchestra to join in very shortly. So the Warner Brothers Orchestra was brought in for that. And that, of course, adds to the unbelievable power of that sequence.
Hal Wallace is a producer who's probably not that well known today outside of real film historians and aficionados. I tend to think of him primarily as the producer of the Elvis films, or at least the early ones. And then occasionally some very good films like Beckett with Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton. But he was also very active in the 40s and 50s. And perhaps you could illuminate us on this point. Was Warner Brothers his home studio or his studio where he originally was producing?
Yes, Hal Wallace, who's credited with being the producer of Casablanca, rose to power as a production executive with a man we've discussed many times here, Daryl F. Zanuck.
Yes.
They were co-running production. They each had their own giant divisions, I believe in the late 20s. There was competition there. When Zanuck left Warner's over a political dispute at the studio in 33, then Wallace took over primarily the activities and production supervision under Warner. And so throughout the 30s and into the 40s, he's going to step back and be just a producer under Warner's around 44. So he's not going to be overseeing the whole slate of pictures. But he is very much responsible for the look and the feel of the Warner Brothers films at that time and establishing a mood and an atmosphere that is so vital in a film like Casablanca, which has that feel of a classic Warner Brothers film of that period.
And then we have a director, which many of our regular listeners are familiar with, I think making his third appearance, Michael Curtiz. We revisited The Breaking Point with John Garfield and also A Young Man with a Horn with Kirk Douglas. So this is the hat trick for Mr. Curtiz, I guess. Gary, certainly his most famous film.
Gary, don't forget Mildred Pierce.
Oh my goodness, that's right. Four. Grand slam for Mr. Curtiz. Excuse me. Thank you, Daniel.
I know it was one of the DVDs that came out from Warner's. There was a segment on Michael Curtiz, quote, the great director you've probably never heard of, something to that effect. We all know, we all have our favorite line. Do you have a particular favorite line from Casablanca?
Well, we could say round up the usual suspects. So that would be the answer to the question then.
Oh, yes. And some of the best ones going to Claude Rains. But there was one that I totally had forgotten that I was laughing out loud when Bogart makes a wager with Rains and he's asking for 20,000 francs. If he wins, Rains says, make it 10. I'm only a poor corrupt official. And that I had completely forgotten that line. The Germans have outlawed miracles and Claude told his men to be especially destructive to Rick's Cafe when they were searching it. So We can go on, but I would love at this point to bring in our very, very special guest, Alan K. Rohde, who is, through the efforts of Dan Cahill's putting us in touch with him, is agreed to join us today to talk about Casablanca. Alan K. Rohde is a biographer and a film scholar. He's the executive producer and host of the Arthur Lyons Film Noir Festival in Palm Springs, that celebrated its 22nd year in May of last year. He's the co-programmer and co-host of Noir City Hollywood and Chicago film festivals and a charter director and treasurer of the Film Noir Foundation. He's very, very important in the world of film noir studies. You've heard his name or you've heard him speak on various DVD commentaries and seen his essays. His latest book, Blood on the Moon, is due out in March. from the University of New Mexico Press, which is going to be about classic Western film and analyzes the post-World War II melding of the film noir cinematic style with the American Western. Previously, he published his biography, Michael Curtiz, A Life in Film, which came out in November of 2017 and now is available in audio and paperback editions. He's co-produced several Film Noir Foundation film restorations and Blu-ray releases with Flickr Alley. And needless to say, we couldn't be more thrilled to have Alan K. Rohde with us today. We catch him in the midst of responding to an inquiry I had about Casablanca being a film noir, considering it has low lighting, Venetian blind shadows, women of intrigue, doomed lovers, political intrigue. Alan K. Rohde didn't agree with that, and here is his response.
Hal Wallace really learned at Zanuck's elbow, took over, and produced a string of great films. Wallace and Curtiz were really the yin and yang, as I write in my book, of Warner Brothers. They both rose together. And from a time where Curtiz was erroneously thought of as a studio vocational mechanic, as it were, that he just shot the script and he couldn't speak English well and blah, blah, blah. And in doing the research in my book that took 6 years, I found out it was the complete opposite, that Curtiz would agree to everything that Wallace and Zanuck wanted to do, and then he would go down the set and try to make his own movie and change the script, change wardrobe, do all of this, and really drove Wallace around the bend to the point where during the charge of the Light Brigade in 1936, Wallace almost fired him. And Curtiz finally compromised and bent his knee in large part because he had seen what happens to people who cross the Warners. And by another part, his American citizenship had not come through yet, even though he had been at Warner Brothers for 10 years since 1926. He was able to compromise, and Wallace and Curtiz became great, great close friends. They rode horses together. Curtiz was a great polo player and so on and so forth. So this collaboration of Casablanca after, you know, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Angels with Dirty Faces, Captain Blood, The Sea Wolf, all of the great films that Wallace and Curtiz collaborated on. Wallace was so involved is that he took Arthur Edison, who was the cinematographer, and in a series of memos was just basically berating him. It's not dark enough. I want more smoke. I want more of this. I want that film noir look. But no one in 1942 knew what the hell film noir was in Hollywood. I mean, they didn't even know into the 1950s. But at its heart, Casablanca is, as you had said, a wartime boosting propaganda film. And it was also a romantic film, a very romantic film. And I think there's a tendency now to use the word noir to sell black and white movies that aren't a Western or an Abbott and Costello movie made during the 1940s and 50s and say that it's film noir. But I really don't think that that's the case.
Well stated. So this was based on a stage play that was unproduced, and Noah Eisenberg wrote a memorable, effective book about Casablanca called We'll Always Have Casablanca 5 years ago. And he indicated that in many ways, the film followed the play pretty closely in many instances. Are you in agreement there?
Yes, I am. There's no question about that. I've read the play by Murray Barnett and Joan Allison. And Barnett's inspiration came during a trip to Europe in 1938 and going to cafes, and also the virulent anti-Semitism that he saw in Vienna also colored a lot of the social commentary in Casablanca. And what's interesting is 30 years after the film was released, Burnett actually sued one of the screenwriters, Howard Koch. And essentially, there were a number of writers, because these writers, the way Warner Brothers and the studios worked is you had a producer that used this writer for this version or to punch up this script or to polish this. But it was never a collaboration. These people never sat in a room together and worked together. Wallace was controlling it. It was analogous to like a bicycle wheel. And Wallace was the guy putting the spokes in with the different riders. So it was basically Epstein brothers. And generally speaking, they did a lot of the humor You know, I'm shocked.
Shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out.
And all of that. The Germans wore gray, you wore blue. One of my favorite lines from the film. You know, what a nice thing to say to Ingrid Bergman. But they did a lot of the humor and the light stuff. And then Howard Koch was brought in to write another script that got merged. And Howard Koch was a real political lefty. I don't think he was a member of the CPUSA. I don't think he was a Communist Party member, but he was very, very much left. And being left and being anti-fascist in 1942 was a pretty popular sentiment. And so Koch put a lot of the stuff into Casablanca about who was Rick. And he was running guns to Ethiopia, and he has that exchange with Claude Rains where Claude Rains points it out, saying, "You're really a closet liberal, a rank sentimentalist."
You fought in Spain on the loyalist side.
And got well paid for it on both occasions.
The winning side would have paid you much better.
And Bogart kind of shrugs. So Koch put all the kind of speechifying and patriotism and anti-fascism in it. And then Wallace brought in Casey Robinson. At the end, I turned every page in the Warner archive on Casablanca and just about all of Curtiz's films. And what Curtiz and Casey Robinson said is the melodrama is good, the characterizations are good, everything is good, but the love story is deficient. Why is Bogart, you know, down in the dumps, sitting there drinking after Bergman comes up? You have to have more about the love story. And from that, he and Curtiz devised this whole flashback sequence where he's in Paris opening the champagne bottle with Bergman and they're in love.
I know so very little about you.
I know very little about you. Just the fact that you had your teeth straightened.
But be serious, darling. You are in danger.
And then the Germans come in. But it was really Howard Koch and the Epstein twins. All three of them won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay. Rightfully so, I might add.
Noah Eisenberg gave a great example of what you're talking about these different writers contributing different things. For example, from what I understand it, it was Howard Koch who wrote the line, "I don't buy and sell human beings." And the Epstein twins wrote the response, "That's too bad. It's Casablanca's most enterprising commodity."
That's a perfect separation of the styles of the two writers. The Epstein brothers were one of the few people that poked fun at Warner Brothers and the movie industry generally. And in 1946, there was a strike riot between the IATSE and the Conference of Studio Unions outside the Warner Gate. And they had sluggers there beating up the CSU people and the Burbank police, and cars were overturned. And my late friend Marsha Hunt actually went down there and watched that because she wanted to find out what was going on. And Jack Warner and his retinue watched all this mayhem from the soundstage roof like spectators. And after that, Julie Epstein suggested that the motto at the time of Warner Brothers that Harry Warner came up with was combining good picture making with good citizenship. And Julie Epstein said they should change that to combining good picture making with good marksmanship.
Wow.
So he was not afraid to poke fun at the Warners and at the industry generally. And of course, in the late 40s, when Jack Warner testified in front of UAC in closed session, he threw all his writers, including the Epsteins and Howard Koch, under the bus by accusing them of being communists and being disloyal.
Absolutely. And the dialogue is astonishing in Casablanca. The writing is astonishing, but the visual look is also astonishing. At this point, let's bring Dan Cahill in, our cinematography expert, who can share with us. Once again, not an enviable task considering all the memorable angles and camera, the images from Casablanca. Dan, what do you have to tell us about Casablanca?
Oh boy, what do you want to hear?
I got a lot.
First of all, we are here in Casablanca, which is now the largest city in Morocco, located on the upper left corner of Africa. Before we go any further, I just want to settle a point and bring the truth out at last. Much as I hate to contradict Captain Reynaud, Casablanca is not in the desert. It's hundreds of miles away from anything looking like a desert. It's a major port on the Atlantic Ocean. So alas, another misleading bit of misinformation from Hollywood. One thing that cinematographers pride themselves on, especially now that a lot of filmmaking has moved out of the studio into the real world, is trying to motivate your light sources, to be able to justify them and say, oh, well, that's the sun coming in through the window, or somebody left the kitchen door open, or that's the candle on the left. We have an early shot which reminds us that there is always a searchlight going back and forth in front of Rick's. Shadows play a very important part, and all of the shadows in this film look like they're well motivated. We have Humphrey Bogart immersed in shadow. This man at this moment is living in shadows and probably glad that his drinking habit is cast in the shadows as well. All water needs to be lit from the side, especially if it's in falling drops, and casting a shadow on Ingrid Bergman's tear makes it all the more emotional for us. And this may have been one of the things that Hal Wallace wanted in the film. Venetian blinds, you can't do a noir look without Venetian blinds. Other things that I've got a couple more instances that I wanted to refer to. One is a wonderful article in the November 7th New Yorker about a month ago. And it's about the Iranian director Asghar Farhadi, who has been getting in a bit of trouble lately. Now, if you don't know this man, you should look up his films. One of them won an Oscar for Best Foreign Film. That would be A Separation.
He's won two Oscars, actually, for Best Foreign Film.
I'm not surprised.
The Salesman, I think, was the other one.
His most recent film, A Hero, has gotten him into some trouble.
Brilliant film. Brilliant film.
Yes, they're all brilliant. Yeah. But the question is, how does he manage to make these films in a culture like Iran? So I have some answers come in this article, which is fascinating, and you should look for it. A female student has accused him of plagiarizing her story idea for A Hero. Okay, this has escalated to the point where it's become sort of a public scandal, especially within the film business there. And I'm going to read you a paragraph or two here from the New Yorker piece. The head of the House of Cinema in Iran, which is a film guild supported by the government, went to the student and told her that people could use her accusation as an opportunity to impugn the prestige of Iranian cinema. He reminded her of one of the last scenes of Casablanca, when the hero, Rick, conceals the truth by telling the husband of a woman he still loves that their romance is over, before helping them escape the Nazis. The student, who knew the scene well, said, "He doesn't lie, but he doesn't tell the truth." "This is what we've learned from cinema," the head of the Cinema Guild said. He advised her to think carefully about the moral implications of telling the truth. Was it right to tell someone in the loud voice that she had too many freckles on her face? Or to tell a person that her nail polish was poorly done? He said, quote, "The difference between telling the truth and shamelessness is a very thin hair," unquote. Well, this is yet another lesson that people have retained from our favorite film here. And I'd like to sneak in one more little thought here. Gary and Max have shared their first experiences with the film. Mine, I can beat you. Mine was in the summer of 1968. I was in the Peace Corps in Morocco. And during our training in Denver that summer, the staff thought, well, what the heck? It's not accurate, but let's rent a 16 millimeter film of Casablanca and project it for the kids. And we loved it so much, most of us had not seen it before. We loved it so much, we wouldn't let them return it to the rental house. They had to keep it for an extra couple of days and show it two more times. Oh. So, lasting influence.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Alan, any thoughts from you on the enduring power of Casablanca? Because yes, it's of a time and place, yet 80 years later, it still touches audiences.
The late Andrew Saris described it in his book about directors that he gives short shrift to Michael Curtiz as a happy accident. And I prefer to think that Casablanca was something that happened accidentally on purpose. And by that, I mean, this was a confluence of timing having to do with the war. And Jack Warner was very clever. The initial premiere was right around the Casablanca conference. He timed it for that. And then in 43, the general release was when the American army went into North Africa. So he was very savvy in that way. So timing had a lot to do with it. And I think it was really the studio system at its best. You had a great producer in Hal Wallace working at peak pitch at Warner Brothers at that time. I think he was supervising four or five other films at that time. You had a great director in terms of Michael Curtiz, great writing, great cast, and it was the stable of Warner Brothers writers that contributed to all of this. So I think it was a combination of timing, ingredients, and skill. In fact, Wallace even said that when it was in pre-release and people looked at it, he got a phone call from the Hollywood's chief censor, Joseph Ignatius Breen, who was kind of like the Pope of Hollywood enforcing the production code. And out of the blue sky, Breen called him and raved about Casablanca and said, you know, this may be the best picture I've looked at. And Breen looked at every picture and he knew nothing about what should be in movies save what shouldn't be in them. So it really started this thing. I remember my old friend, the late producer Stanley Rubin, was talking about meeting his wife or doing something. And he said, well, you know, as far as a woman's quality, does she tear up at the end of Casablanca? You know, that was kind of a litmus test. And what's interesting is the ending of the movie. Bergman wrote, I think, in her book that no one knew whether she was going to go away with Paul Henreid or stay with Bogart and so forth. I don't agree with that. Everyone knew, first off, from a contemporary culture point of view, she was not going to abandon her noble husband to stay with her lover bartender in Casablanca. That was never going to happen. What they had to figure out was, how can we make it clean so it feels good? At that point, Koch was rewriting, and came up with the whole thing about a higher goal than their love and romance. And where Bogart makes that speech, you know, I've got things to do you can't be a part of. You're the guy that keeps Victor Laszlo going. You're his life. And interestingly, there was a real argument in the morning that scene was shot between Bogart and Curtiz that got so contentious that Wallace had to leave his office and come down to the set to arbitrate between Bogart and Curtiz. And Wallace rarely did that when he was at Warner Brothers. And there's a lot of speculation. Curtiz's last significant other said it was over how the ending was supposed to be shaped. Also, Bogart had a habit by that time of coming in the morning and not knowing his lines. And this happened on Dead Reckoning, Deadline USA. And he might have just been provoking an argument, so he had time to go over his lines and learn his lines. That's speculatory, but that did happen to him in other instances. But whatever it was, it got ironed out. And I think the ending of Casablanca elevated it in the film to a rarefied atmosphere that there's certain films like Citizen Kane, Casablanca, and others that transcend cinema and us talking about movies, that becomes a permanent part of the culture. And I mean, it's kind of like those tentpole movies like The Wizard of Oz, Casablanca. Every anniversary, there'll be a new and better version of something. And they recycled the 75-year or 70th-year anniversary where I was a talking head in a Michael Curtiz featurette and so forth. So I think Casablanca endures because people identify with the emotions and the feeling of doing the right thing, even when it hurts, falling in love, losing that love, and someone who is dedicated to something more than himself. And I think that those emotions resonate with all of us.
And I have a hard time watching the movie without getting verklempt at certain moments. Oh, it's just always there.
Yeah. So. Interesting, Daniel, about the cinematography. Wallace wanted James Wong Howe to shoot this movie.
Sure, why not?
And this was part of Jack Warner's divide and conquer method of running the studio, where even Wallace, who got this big independent production contract where he could say it's a Hal Wallace production and he supposedly would get access to the best scripts and the best talent, which that contract led to the falling out between he and Jack Warner that was crystallized when Casablanca won Best Picture and Hal Wallace got up to accept the award and was sitting with the Warners, and the Warners stretched their legs out at the Chinese Theater, blocked him from going up there so Jack Warner could run up and take the Oscar from Jack Benny, who was the host. True story. And after that evening, everyone knew that Hal Wallace would be leaving Warner Brothers shortly after that episode. So Wallace, with all of his power, could not get James Wong Howe. And because he was assigned to the hard way, and the studio manager talked to Warner. Warner said, screw him, don't move him. He'll have to use Arthur Edison, who is a great cinematographer who shot Frankenstein and the Maltese Falcon, started way back in Eclair. But poor Arthur Edison had both Wallace and Curtiz riding him constantly. The shot where you see the choreography of bustle in Rick's Cafe, with that long dolly shot of all the refugees sitting at the tables and so forth. That first day, Curtiz chewed him out because he took 90 minutes to light the entire set. And Jack Warner's guidance to directors and producers during his tenure as the studio head could be summed up in two words, and those are hurry up. Warner Brothers was a sharp-elbowed, tough, working-class studio. I mean, when you think of the stars like Edward G. Robinson and James Cagney and Ann Sheridan and those, you would never see those people at MGM. MGM, you would see a film lit like F.A.O. Schwartz's window on Christmas Day with all these lights and everything like that. And it was just a completely different kind of studio, a great studio, I might add.
That's fabulous. Let's talk a little more about the actors. The Bogart is finally getting above, you know, top billing. Warner is finally acknowledging him as a star after leading him along for so long. Ingrid Bergman's on loan from Selznick. The other actors, someone asked me the other day, you have so many European emigres, many who had to flee Nazism cast. That could not have been a coincidence. I imagine people like Dalio and S.Z. Sakal and others. Could you share some, any, and this could be anyone.
Well, here's a couple vignettes on that. First off, Curtiz cast all of those actors. I mean, he didn't cast Bergman. He didn't cast Henry. Henry actually turned it down. And Curtiz wanted Philip Dorn, who was tied up over at MGM with something. And there's memos between he and Wallace saying, I don't think we can get anybody with an accent to play Victor Laszlo and so forth, and suggested a couple people that I think would have been awful. And he said, I think Henry will turn it down. And initially Henry did turn it down because he said, hey, I don't get the girl. I'm not above the title. So Wallace bought out his contract with RKO and put his name above the title and sweeten the deal. So he went ahead and did the picture. Curtiz was singularly responsible for getting S.Z. Zakal in the movie and craved his humor. And of course, Zakal's real name was Jacob Garo, and he was a Hungarian music hall comedian back in the day when Curtiz was making films during World War I in Hungary. So they were old pals and he wanted to get him in, but Zakal wanted more money than Wallace was willing to pay. And of course, Curtiz ended up forging a compromise and got Zakal in. But all of the other people were mostly refugees. And the guy that played the big doorman standing outside the gambling arena was an actor named Dan Seymour, who late in life ended up being the executor of Fritz Lang's estate and was in a lot of Fritz's films.
Yeah.
And he was on set when the La Marseillaise scene. And he said, I looked around and these people were actually crying. And I realized these people were refugees. They were, most of them were Jewish. In fact, Mr. Leuchtag, remember Mr. Leuchtag at the table? He's asking what time it is and they're trying to do that. Well, he was, he's a distant relative to me by marriage. And he later on, he was doing those little old Italian Swiss colony wine commercials in the 60s dressed in Lederhosen, that little but yeah, he was related to my great aunt Emmy. Claude Rains was perfect, although the Epsteins kind of thought, well, how are you going to have an English guy play a French policeman in North Africa? But they wrote their best. I mean, Rains has the best pithy dialogue in the entire movie.
You every know? Line out of him is a zinger without exception. Yeah.
Particularly at the end where Bogart's telling Ingrid Bergman, 10-1 we'd all end up in a concentration camp. Wouldn't we, Louis? And he goes, I'm afraid Major Strasser would insist. I mean, it's just so good. Yeah. And of course, Conrad Veidt Here's a guy who was virulently anti-Nazi, got out of Germany, came to Hollywood so he could play Nazis.
I mean, and he died not long after the film was in release.
Yeah, that's correct. I think he died on a golf course of a heart attack. But he was great. Everybody in there, the casting, Curtiz giving Sidney Greenstreet the fly swatter in the Blue Parrot Cafe, you know, going like this. Hal Wallace put the parrot outside. He said, put a parrot outside the Blue Parrot Cafe. The other thing about Casablanca, it was being written as the film was being shot, which was very out of character with Wallace, because Wallace liked to have a complete script for obvious reasons, including budgetary reasons, when the film started. And it didn't work out that way. So Casablanca, at its core, was a film that everyone involved in it, to the last possible minute, tried to make better, even to the point of the ending where Rains and Bogart walk off in stage one. And by the way, that whole last sequence was not shot at an airport. It was shot at stage one with a mock-up small model plane and short people as the attendants way off in the distance in the plane. So that, you know, that line.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Wallace came up with that. And the picture had already wrapped. Bogart was on his yacht and they called Bogart back in to dub the line.
The New York film critics in 1942 voted Casablanca best picture of the year, but apparently was not Oscar eligible that year. It was not until 1943, the following year, that the film won the Oscar. Was this because of the troop movements? And
I think it was because in 42, it had like a one premiere night in Hollywood or New York, but it didn't have enough of a run, I think, in 42 to qualify. So it was went into general release in 43, and then it won the Oscars in March of 1944. In fact, my book on Curtiz, I open it with the March 2, 1944 Oscar ceremony, which was very different because up until that time, the Oscars had pretty much been an insular dinner type of format at the Biltmore and so on and so forth. People like Cary Grant kind of decried the Oscars and the Academy Awards turning into a big show for everybody. All their colleagues would have dinner together and they'd give each other awards and hang out, and the public wasn't invited. But then it became a big deal and they held it at Grauman's Chinese in 44. It was put on a radio broadcast, on the Armed Services radio broadcast. Jack Benny was the host, and he said, I'm here because Bob Hope had a cold, and he was the MC, and so forth. And they let in all these servicemen to fill Grauman's Chinese Theater, and then you had Zanuck in uniform, Ronald Reagan in uniform, and the opening speech by Walter Wanger was that, you know, the motion picture industry puts service to our country above all else. Even the Academy Awards went on a wartime footing.
So it was not a sign of lack of confidence in the picture by Warner Brothers. It was just
not at all. In fact, Hal Wallace, when he did a AFI seminar near the end, when asked about Casablanca, he said, we just started out to make a good picture. We never dreamed it would become a classic. And I think that's a very honest answer. He also took umbrage at some young filmmaker that asked him, well, what about you didn't have that many great directors or so on? And he got highly irate and he said, Michael Curtiz is as great a director as anybody who ever worked in Hollywood, and basically politely kind of dressed this young man down for impugning that Michael Curtiz was not a great director. And that was that loyalty, because the two of them rose together, stayed friends. And near the end of Curtiz's life, he had Curtiz come back and direct Elvis Presley in King Creole, which is Elvis.
Good film. Yeah.
Elvis said it was his best film, and he said, I finally have a director who knows how to direct me. And I showed that film at my film festival with the actress who played Elvis's sister, who's in her 90s and still with us. It's a terrific film because Elvis actually plays a character that's not Elvis. Even though he sings and all of that, that was woven into the story, and I think it's Elvis's best picture. So Curtiz directed whole and in part 181 movies. Mm. I mean, that is mind-boggling. And of course, not all of those movies are great. A lot of his movies in Hungary have been lost, but many of them are. He could even take a bad script and make something out of it, make it move. One of the many Curtizism attributed to him is somebody pointed out, well, Mike, you know, the script doesn't say that this person does this and you're having them do this. And he goes, don't worry. I make it move so fast, they'll never know.
What can I say? This has been an absolutely amazing talk back. And Daniel, thank you for introducing us to Alan and Alan K. Rohde.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez and film curator Gary Palmucci. We would also like to give a warm thanks to cinematography expert Dan Cahill, our special guest Alan K. Rohde, as well as Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the production of this podcast possible. This podcast was directed, produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and be sure to tune in next time to hear the history and insider production scoop behind one of the most iconic sci-fi films of the 20th century, The Day the Earth Stood Still.